Today on Maine Calling, COVID's summertime surge and other public health concerns, an encore presentation. You likely know someone who has come down with COVID recently. Cases are up in Maine and many other states. Maine's wastewater surveillance data confirms high levels of the COVID virus. There are also other viruses spreading this summer, and public health officials are warning us about tick-borne diseases and rabies. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we listen back to our recent program with medical leaders in Maine about what we're seeing in Maine hospitals and how to protect ourselves this summer. We learned about the latest vaccine guidance and the national surge in whooping cough. Plus, we received an update on Maine's opioid summit. Our originally scheduled program for today, The Need for Nuance, had to be postponed. We hope to reschedule it soon. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling On Demand is made possible in part by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. By Welch & Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at WelchForbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, supporting Maine island communities through education, health, and community engagement. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. You may have noticed more people are coming down with COVID-19 lately. We will discuss this recent uptick in cases, as well as the latest vaccination recommendations, and we will learn what's happening with other public health concerns on today's program. Joining me, the A-team, Dr. Pateri Vaugh, Director of the Maine Center for Disease Control and Prevention, Dr. Dora Ann Mills, Chief Health Improvement Officer for Maine Health, and Dr. James Jarvis, Physician Leader, Incident Command, and Director of Clinical Education with Northern Light Health. We invite you to join the conversation. This is your chance to ask questions about public health issues that you are wondering about. Send an email, a brief email, please, to talk@mainepublic.org. Post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Welcome to all of you. And I'm going to start by going to you, Dr. Vaugh, because I know that you have just scooted out of the Opioid Response Summit for a little while, and we'll be going back there this afternoon. What have we learned so far at the Opioid Response Summit? I understand the cases are down, but still a lot higher. Overdose cases are down, but still a lot higher than you'd like to see.
Good morning, everyone, and good morning, Jen. This is great. I am so happy to be able to join and scoot away from the summit to join this A-team. In regards to the summit, coming into this, I would say that the energy is joyful, optimistic, and the folks are committed. There are about 1,400 people that are joining us here today at the summit. And so you can tell just from that alone and the conversations, discussions that are happening, how committed the state of Maine is. And I have to call out, I want to call out the leadership of Governor Mills, her vision for this work, the leadership of our opioid response director, Gordon Smith. They had a vision. And what we're seeing is that vision is coming to fruition. And we hear that in the stories that are being shared. Just for the folks on the call, so they know why I feel excited about the work that's being done, is that last year, Maine reported, it was one of four states that reported a significant decline in fatal overdoses, opioid overdoses, 16%, I believe. And this year, with cautious optimism, we're seeing potentially a repeat in that trend. It's heading towards that direction of potentially greater than 15% decline. And again, fatal overdoses due to opioids. That says something. What it tells us is that all this commitment and work that the state of Maine is doing, this level of partnership, collaboration, this collective effort from the ground up and up down and all around, all of that is actually working. And I do want to end with this, though, in terms of the energy, is that everyone knows that, we are celebrating these moments, But there's so much work to be done, right, in the sphere of prevention, intervention, and support and care to the community that need it most. This work is going to be ongoing, and that's what we're doing today, is celebrating the wins that we have, but trying to also figure out what else needs to be done so that we can keep at this.
And I want to ask, what do we attribute the decline in the overdose death rate to? Is it because fewer people are using opioids, or is it because there's more widespread use of Narcan to reverse overdoses?
You know, it's not any one thing, right? Which we always we learn in this public health sphere, in our healthcare sphere, and caring for people. It's a multitude of things converging all at once. It's one, we're reducing the stigma. We're speaking about this. We're bringing awareness, lifting up that veil, saying that this is an issue and we have to address it head on. And we're creating a welcoming environment so that people understand that it's okay to seek help when you need it most. And this is how you're going to do it. These are the resources available. So just speaking about it at this level of discussion at all levels is really important, because that reduces stigma. In addition to that is, we know in terms of the national trends, like the supply of, you know, opioids, it's a lot, right? So what can we do to help? What can we do to help people and help families and help communities? What it means is that there are multiple pillars to this response, including prevention. And I want to highlight that, because it's not all about intervention and harm reduction. We start with prevention. How do we support families, which we discuss and we talk about in the work that we do at Maine CDC and with our partners on the ground? We talk about how do we promote prevention with schools. And so there's preventative work happening at the school level, including, you know, increasing peer leadership, peer support. In addition to that, we support school-based health centers so that we are able to connect kids who need it most, who have a history of use. And if they're ready to change, we connect them to treatment. There's a continuum of care that's needed across the different pillars of this response. And I just want to highlight, that's the degree of work that's needed. In addition to, yes, Narcan, the availability of Narcan naloxone. That's right. Also helping.
I want to turn, and I'll turn to you, Dr. Mills. I want to talk about the reason we scheduled the program today. Unfortunately, we're seeing a surge in COVID cases. I know that the CDC under Dr. Vaugh has found a surge in the wastewater surveillance, but we're also seeing this on the ground. I know several people who have come down with COVID here in Maine, and friends who live in other places. But what are you seeing at the hospital, Dr. Mills? How many of these people who are getting COVID are getting it so badly that they need to be hospitalized?
Yes, so we are seeing an uptick in the hospital, in our hospitals at Maine Health, and I think Jim will probably say something similar at Northern Light Health and across the state. I think we're seeing that. It is, the good news is that our hospitalizations are still really low compared to pre-COVID, compared to where they used to be 2 or 3 years ago. So just to give you some comparison data, you know, we at Maine Health back in June, May and June, we saw 0 to maybe 5 patients on any given day hospitalized because of COVID. And that number is up to around 15, sometimes 20, you know, these days. So it has certainly increased. But when I think back to 2022, that number was about 200 during a couple of our surges then. And statewide, they were about 500 back then. And I think right now, statewide, we're seeing about 30 or so patients per day hospitalized with COVID. And again, a couple of years ago, it was upwards of about 500. So we're much better than we used to be. And I attribute that to the increase in immunity across our population due to vaccinations, due to people having contracted the disease, sometimes 2 or 3 or 4 times. And so we do have, you know, vaccination is like water on the fire. And so we've had a lot of that water. You know, we've had a lot of people have gotten vaccinated. We have a lot of people have gotten contracted the infection. And so we have a lot more immunity. And what that's doing is it's even though there are a lot more people, I mean, a lot of people we believe are contracting COVID. And again, we don't have firm numbers on the people who are just contracting it. We have better numbers of those who are hospitalized or sadly dying from it. And we still see about 1 a day dying from it in Maine right now. But what we think that increased immunity due to vaccinations particularly is resulting in is many, many fewer people becoming sick enough to be hospitalized from it. So there are a lot, you know, anecdotally, we hear about it, as I've heard too, lots of people I seem to know and run into these days that, you know, I just got out of, over COVID, or hearing about it from my physician colleagues. They're saying they're seeing a lot of people calling in and saying they've got COVID. How can they get a prescription for Paxlovid, for instance, the medication to treat it? So we're hearing about a lot of cases, but it seems that proportionally fewer of them are sick enough to be hospitalized, and that's good news.
And Dr. Jarvis, are your rates about the same?
Yeah, we're seeing about the same things across the Northern Light system as well. Today, Eastern Maine Medical Center, our flagship hospital, is in the low double digits, which, you know, before the summer, we were not seeing those. Like Dora said, we were seeing numbers of, you know, 0 to 5 patients at most. Not all of those patients are admitted because of COVID. Some of them were admitted for other reasons, but had symptoms suggested of it. And so we tested them and then make sure that we are keeping those people safe and the other people in the hospital and our staff safe as well. And so it is definitely a higher number now than what we were talking about pre-summer. I will, you know, similarly seeing our outpatient providers, though, saying that they are getting a lot more calls for people who have symptoms and either have tested or wish to test for COVID and testing, then subsequently testing positive. So it's definitely out in our communities. We know that people are gathering a whole lot more now, and that's really good to see that we're doing that. But I think this is the call for us to remind ourselves that, especially for those who are most vulnerable, so those people who are over the age of 65, or those who have heart disease or lung disease or being treated for things like cancer or diabetes, that they still are at risk for severe disease, regardless of whether they've been vaccinated or not, when we start seeing a higher number of people who are infected within our communities. So those people should be taking care now. So they may want to consider wearing a mask when they're out in public, particularly if they're going to be in a space where there are a lot of people who they don't know. So like, this is concert season, this is fair season. And so those kind of things should be there. People should remembering, though, to do good hygiene measures. So cough and sneeze into their nose, cough or sneeze into their elbow or a tissue, and making sure they're not spreading disease that way, washing hands frequently. And please, please, please stay home if you're not feeling well, particularly if you have a fever.
And I'll ask you this question. This is an email from Kathy because it's so related to what we're talking about. Kathy says, so if you test positive, what is the current thinking not to spread? Shelter till you test negative, then mask for additional 5 days?
So I don't know if somebody else wants to chime in. What I've been telling patients is that they should definitely be staying home while they have a fever, and that they need to be fever-free for about 24 hours after taking something like Tylenol or Motrin that can help bring fevers down. Then if they go out in the community, I ask my patients to mask at least for the next 5 days after that, just simply to make sure that we're not spreading the virus. Others can chime in what they would like to say. We know that it is kind of confusing out there because there is different guidance for healthcare workers versus for the general population.
Dr. Jarvis did a fantastic job. He's absolutely correct. He's, you know, to that question. That's a really good question because Jim is correct. There are so many, depending on if you're a worker or if you're part of the public, right? But to keep it simple, USCDC recommends that you isolate, you shelter while you are symptomatic. And if you have a fever, you can remove yourself from isolation if you are fever free for more than 24 hours and your symptoms are improving. To Dr. To Jim's point, you know, that's without taking ibuprofen or Tylenol. Now, what do you do after that? Do you just go outside? I would recommend those same things along with Jim, Dora, and USCDC, which I would still recommend that you mask up as well for the remaining 5 days. You can test. The option that Jen was bringing up is that you can test, actually, until you test negative, if you want to add that extra layer of caution. But really, shelter in place or isolate while you are symptomatic and febrile with a fever. If those things are resolving, no fever for over 24 hours without the help of medicine, then you can go out into the public, but please wear a mask.
And lots of questions. Go ahead, Dora.
Sorry, I was just going to add that I agree with everything that Jim and Terry said. And I would just add that these are also very, pretty much the same recommendations as if you have any kinds of respiratory illness. So if you've got flu, if you have RSV, if you've got, we don't know what, but you've got a fever and respiratory symptoms, you're coughing, you've got a runny nose, sore throat, whatever, stay home. Stay home if you're sick. Mask around others at home. And then, when you're fever free for 24 hours and your symptoms are improving, it's okay to go out. But it's also a good idea to mask if you still got, respiratory symptoms. And particularly if you've got COVID, you're masking for about 5 more days or until you're testing negative. So it's just a good idea. It's called respiratory hygiene. Just, make sure that we're just not spreading these respiratory illnesses to other people, because many other people are at high risk, even if you're not. And for them, it can be a much more serious illness, whether it's flu or RSV or some other bug or COVID.
So we have lots of questions about vaccines, and I want to get to those after the break. But before the break, Dr. Jarvis, I want to ask you this. I know several people who have been very sick recently who did not test positive for COVID. Their symptoms were similar to COVID, very tired, sore throat. They were certain they had it, but over and over again tested negative. What's going on? Is there another respiratory illness going on, or is there a variety, a strain of COVID that's not being picked up in tests?
Yeah, so I don't think we've found that there's any strain of COVID that doesn't really get picked up with the standard tests. We do know that some people early on in their disease process might test negative, but if you're telling me that somebody's tested serial and they're negative, they probably do not have coronavirus. But there are definitely some other viruses out there that happen during our summer months. We used to call that the summer cold. But they're just other respiratory viruses that are out there that can mimic and have those same kind of things. And we do know that there is still some flu activity here in the state of Maine, most of which now is around influenza B. And when we talk about influenza B, that's the one that kind of scares doctors a little bit more. We often don't have the best mix for the vaccine for influenza B, and it often causes more severe illness and goes unrecognized because it usually happens later on in our season here in Maine, including over the summer. And so that's another reason why it's so important that people get their annual vaccines, both against flu and COVID. And I'm sure we'll talk about that after the break.
So if somebody has gotten this and it's the flu, is it last year's flu or is it early for this year's? We think of it around September, October, or does it
So
matter?
it's Yeah, it probably doesn't matter much, and it probably is still, quote, last year's flu. But we also know that people worldwide travel, and we also know that flu season in the southern hemisphere has already started with high activities in some countries like Australia. And so if people are intermixing with people who have traveled internationally, it's always possible to get last year's strain, this year's strain. Again, the virus has no idea what the calendar is. It just does its own thing.
We will talk about the latest recommendations for vaccinations after our break. We'll be right back. And a note, this program is a rebroadcast of an earlier show. We are not taking any phone calls or responding to emails or social media posts. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you are listening to Maine Calling. Today, we are getting a public health update with three top medical experts in Maine. With me, Dr. Dora Ann Mills, Chief Health Improvement Officer for Maine Health, Dr. Jim Jarvis, Director of Clinical Education and Physician Leader with Northern Light Health, and Dr. Puteri Vaugh, Director of the Maine CDC. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or call 1-800-399-3566. As I mentioned, a couple different questions about vaccines. I'm going to read them both and then turn to you, Dr. Vaugh. Let's see here. The first one is from Lynette. What are the current recommendations for vaccinating children age 5 and up for COVID-19? Will there be an updated booster available for them this fall? And then Maggie says, had my last COVID vaccine last October. I had to drive out of state. Where do I get the latest vaccine? Fewer places offer it. I've tried to protect myself, still wear a mask at the grocery store. Never had COVID, just want to keep up the protection. Seems to me nobody's getting the most current vaccine and no longer believes COVID is a threat. So, Dr. Voss, some guidance for Maggie, who's looking for getting a vaccine, and then for Lynette, who wants to know about advice for children.
Yeah, so why don't I? Those are great questions from both Lynette and Maggie. In regards to the recommendations for COVID back, just COVID-19 vaccines. Right now, the recommendations are, if you're 65 and older, we are recommending an additional dose of the 2023-2024 vaccine. And what that means is, Lynette, if you and others, and Maggie, like if you and others have not received you're 65 and older and you have not received a vaccine more than 4 months ago, you can get one right now. You are eligible for one right now. Now, what does that mean come the fall? We are expecting a new vaccine, a 2024-2025 COVID vaccine for everyone who's 6 months and older. And so what that means is that even babies 6 months and older will be recommended for them to get this new vaccine come the fall. We're hoping that this will come around sometime in September, but it's unclear right now, but just expect it in the fall.
All right. Let's see here. We have an email from Mary Beth. It is great to hear the data on COVID, but please remember that while 30 people in the hospital is a low number in the hospital, it is 30 friends or family members for someone. A few years back, a friend's husband was the only patient in Maine Med. He stayed there until he passed away. Looking at the data then would be really good as far as numbers go, but this man was someone's husband and my friend. And one of the reasons I read this is I know, Dr. Mills, you couldn't agree more.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And no, that is an excellent point. It's still 30, you know, too many people. And as you said, we're still seeing about one per day or so who are, one per, maybe it's per week. I'm sorry. Anyway, we're still seeing deaths due to COVID in Maine. It's a message to navigate carefully, because you're absolutely right. These are people. These are not just numbers. These are people, and they're somebody's family members and close friends. On one hand, on the other hand, we've also seen tremendous success because of the vaccination efforts, and people, you know, having just increased immunity overall. And so these numbers, the numbers of people impacted, are just severely, at least, are so much lower than they were a couple of years ago. So kind of like what Terry was saying around the opioid epidemic, a lot of success to be celebrated, but a long ways to go as well. So, and I just want to put a point to, I agree with everything Terry mentioned about the vaccinations for COVID, that if you are at high risk, it is recommended you get the vaccine that's currently out there. However, if you do that now, then when the new vaccine, the updated vaccine reflecting the more recently circulating variants of the virus, when that comes out, which we're expecting, I believe, in late August or September, you do need to wait. It's generally, last year I think it was 4 months, but sometimes it's 3 to 4 months after your last dose of vaccine. So I know I've gotten a lot of questions, and I suspect probably Terry and Jim have had as well. So if you're high risk and this was April, that's kind of an easy answer. Get the vaccine now, and then come August, September, get the updated vaccine, because that will have been 4 months. So right now, I think people are having to weigh the risks and the benefits. So if you're very high risk and you're out around in indoor crowded places right now, it's probably, you know, a good idea to talk to your provider about getting the current vaccine, but it also may delay you getting the updated vaccine in a few weeks. I'm sort of at moderate risk. So I'm, you know, myself, I'm playing the odds a little bit. I'm trying to stay more careful. As Jim mentioned, I'm trying to, you know, mask a bit when I'm indoors in crowded places, and being just a bit more careful, because there is an uptick in COVID right now that we did not see in April, but we're seeing it now. So, you know, trying to be a bit more careful, but I kind of want to get to that end of, because I'm not at really high risk. I want to get to that August, September, and get the updated vaccine that is more reflective of the viruses that are currently circulating. So it's kind of a little bit playing the odds of risks and benefits and really talking to your own provider is probably a good idea.
Good,
and
got
if you
it.
Had, if you do get COVID right now too, this summer, then you can get the updated vaccine this fall, 3 months after, probably 3 months will be the recommendation. That's what it was last year after your illness.
And Dr. Fall, I know you wanted to answer the question about where you can get it.
Absolutely. Totally. So sorry for missing that part. I think maybe it was Maggie who was asking about that. Where we can get these vaccines, they should still be available all those same places that they were available before. So these are pharmacies like CVS, Walgreens, Hannaford's, to Dora's point, even at your provider. If you go to see your provider, they should be able to answer that question for you too. And if they don't have it in their office, they should be able to point you to where you can get them. I do want to note, like as Dora was going through that, you can sort of see like that mental calculus that we're all, you know, trying to do this at this point, right? What is our risk? What are we hedging here? And what's the most convenient? I would recommend this. As you're going through that exercise, if that's too much to think about, if you're high risk, go ahead and get one. Get the additional dose, especially if you've been more than 4 months. Because it's even like the variant itself, it's hard to tell how long the surge is going to last and when the next one is coming.
Okay. I do want to ask about tick-borne illnesses, whooping cough, and syphilis, but we have more COVID questions coming in, so we'll try to take care of these two COVID questions and then move on. Sharon says, and I'll send this to you, Dr. Jarvis, what is the current recommendation after exposure to COVID? You've been to a dinner party at someone's house, and they call you the next day and say, I'm so sorry, I just found out I have COVID. What do you do?
Yeah, so that point is actually just monitoring for those people who had that exposure. Now, if it was a really significant one, the person was symptomatic while you were in the room with them, and you were in that room for a period of more than 15 to 30 minutes, you may want to consider doing some isolation for a period of time just to see if you are symptomatic. But beyond that, right now, we really are just recommending that most people just monitor for symptoms and then test if they have symptoms. Now, if you're a person who is at risk or you live with somebody at risk, you may want to do some periodic testing, maybe when your friend called you and let you know that information, and then maybe 2 to 3 days later again. But again, I don't think that's a necessary for the general public, but certainly you may want to consider that if you're in a household with somebody who is at risk for severe disease.
All right. And an email from Stan, are the free COVID home tests still available? If so, how do we get them? No. And we see a lot of shaking of heads. Apparently, go ahead.
They're not through the federal program and the state program where you could just sign up on a website and have them mailed to you. However, I have seen some free ones available. I was in a town office in Western Maine recently, and they had stacks of them for free to give out. I don't know, I'm not sure quite how they got them. They received them through the state program a few months ago or whatever. But I mentioned that to some friends, and they said, oh yeah, their town office has them too. So I think that there are some free ones out there, but I don't think there's a coordinated federal and state program right now to get those out, to get them to individuals through a website. But and they're certainly readily available in pharmacies, but they are, you know, about, I think it's like $22 or $23 for two tests. So it's not inexpensive for sure.
Okay, Dr. Jarvis, I'm going to give you this next one. It's a public health question, but also a little bit of a philosophical question. An email from Laura. I am an elementary public school teacher. Do you have recommendations and guidelines for public school educators to both engage students in outdoor education and provide protection against tick-borne diseases? I'm noticing a sharp and understandable uptick in fear of the outdoors from both students and parents, and I don't want this fear to take away the joy of outdoor learning. What is reasonable?
What a great question, and definitely apropos for me, as my youngest daughter just recently got hired as a new kindergarten teacher here in Maine. So I'm so happy about that.
Congratulations.
So a great shout out there. I don't think there needs to be that apprehension about being afraid of outdoors. In fact, we keep talking about that being outdoors is actually a better way to help prevent the spread of respiratory viruses, which often when we're in a closed indoor area. I think what we really need to do is learn to do just good protection. And so in that case, when we're out and about, we should be wearing clothing that protects us against both ticks and mosquitoes. So I know we're in Maine and it's warm and we want to be out in shorts and short sleeve shirts, but really actually wearing a long sleeve shirt and long pants and particularly socks can help prevent at least tick-borne illnesses, as ticks are actually usually on the ground and crawl up us, not fall from the trees like many people think. So that's one way we can do it, is making sure we're wearing protective clothing. Second, if you know you're going to be in an area where you are going to be at risk of either ticks or mosquitoes, then make sure that you're using some kind of insect repellent spray that can help keep those off of you and keep them, if they do come on you, from biting or lasting very long. And then lastly, and probably most importantly, is after you're done doing your outdoor activity, is do a check of your body for ticks. And if you can't do it, ask somebody who's close to you, who's willing to do it for you. Because that's really what we find happens, is people go out and they think they're fine because they didn't feel that bite, they didn't see anything, and then they've had a tick on them, on their back, that they didn't see for a while. And so that's a really good way of making sure that you protect yourself. But remember, you know, it's not just outdoors. Most people in Maine have pets, and our pets go outside, and then the ticks get on their pets, and then they come inside, and the tick can crawl. And so you really just want to kind of do that all the time. Now, as far as infectious disease goes, yes, we do know that there are increased levels of infectious diseases from both ticks and mosquitoes in our state. And so for this, I say that if you get sick and it seems odd to you and you test negative for COVID or the symptoms are really severe, is please reach out to your provider so that they can determine whether or not you need to be tested for tick or mosquito-borne diseases. And we're really putting that plug out for our primary care providers, our emergency room physicians, and those that work in acute care settings and walk-in care clinics, that they really should have a high suspicion for these things. While rare, when they occur, they can be devastating, but not a reason to stay indoors. It really is a great time here in Maine for us to be outdoors and enjoying the outdoor experience.
And Dr. Jarvis just said, rare, they do happen, and we've already had cases of more than one tick-borne illness in Maine. Why don't you bring us up to speed on what you've seen so far this year in Maine?
Sure, no, Dr. Jarvis is correct. We are continuing to see similar trends. It's not just ticks, it's mosquitoes. So, you know, similar trends as we were seeing last year, for example, we are seeing more mosquito pools test positive, right, for JCV. We've already had a case of Powassan. Unfortunately, it was indeed a Powassan death. We continue to see high activities of Lyme disease. But with all of that, I think it's important because, you know, I don't want people to be fearful of the outside, very similar to what Jim was saying. And to our caller who asked that great question, is that there are precautions that we can take to help protect ourselves so that we can still enjoy being in the outdoors, because I would hate to take that away from kids. Because being outdoors and having fun is also protective, right? So with that being said, all those things that Jim just said, like, what can you do to protect yourself during the summer months? It means long sleeves, long pants, definitely socks over the pants, right? And by the way, because I came from Arizona, it doesn't have to be hot. There are long sleeves, long pants clothes that are meant for hot conditions. So for our listeners, go ahead and check those out too. So, you know, we can do this and balance this with the heat that we're experiencing here in Maine as well, while also enjoying the outdoors. And when you come back, because you're not going to feel those bites necessarily, right? So go ahead and check one another to make sure that there aren't ticks on you, or, you know, if you can prevent mosquito bites, do that. And if you're concerned, I think our basic message is, if you're worried that you might be bitten or you might have had something or you're feeling symptomatic, it doesn't hurt to go and reach out to your provider to ask that question, to see what's appropriate for you in terms of testing and treatment.
We'll go to Beth, who's calling from Owl's Head. Hi, Beth, go ahead.
Oh, hello, thank you. Where are we at with a vaccine for Lyme, for humans?
Dr. Jarvis is raising his hand. I know they were working on it. Where are we?
So right now, there are phase two trials going on for a particular vaccine against Lyme. Northern Light Health participates in those trials. I believe one new hospital in the state actually just announced that they were as well, and unfortunately the name escapes me. So there are trials ongoing right now for what appears to be an effective vaccine. I think we're still a few years away for that to materialize for humans. There has been a vaccine against Lyme for pets, but not for humans. And so I think we're a little bit of ways away from that, but it may be some breakthrough and certainly help in those areas where unfortunately Lyme disease is endemic.
Dr. Mills.
And I just mentioned, yes, there are several hospitals, including Northern Light Health and Maine Health. I think they're particularly choosing hospitals that are, for the clinical trials of the vaccine that are in areas with very high rates of Lyme disease. So Penn Bay Hospital, for instance, in Rockport, Rockland, that's one of the participating hospitals from Maine Health. So, you know, crossing our fingers and toes and everything that we'll have that vaccine in the coming years.
Beth, thank you so much for your call. If you would like to join the conversation, the phone number 1-800-399-3566. If you're quick, you can send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org or post to our Facebook page or Instagram. We'll be right back. This program is a rebroadcast of an earlier show, so we are not taking any phone calls or responding to emails or social media posts. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. This is Maine Calling. We're talking about public health concerns from COVID to, we'll talk about rabies and whooping cough. What are your questions? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Let's talk about rabies for a minute. Dr. Vaugh, I know that the Maine CDC has issued a warning about bats. What have you seen in Maine? Is it different than usual? And how will someone know if an animal is rabid and whether or not they've been bitten?
The first rule here is if you see a wild animal out in the wild, let them be wild. Don't take guesses of whether or not they're bitten or if they may or may not have rabies. So please leave wild animals wild and leave them alone. That is the very first rule. In terms of rabies activity, it's very difficult to know whether or not we're seeing more rabies or less rabies. It's just that we're interacting and seeing our environment much more. And every time you look and you interact, then there's more you're going to find cases. But I think it really goes back to the same message is if you see an animal that is indeed wild, please do not approach the animal. Reach out to the animal controller to the game warden and the animal controllers. Those are the individuals that should be handling the situation. In addition to that, please vaccinate your pets. That's also very important because in addition to you, there are your pets that may be interacting with the environment outdoors and potentially coming across wild animals. And it's really important to vaccinate them so that we can prevent that level of transmission too.
I'm going to follow up though about bats specifically, because if somebody wakes up and there is a bat in their room, they don't know if they've been bitten, correct? There's no way to know if that bat has bitten you, and you need to take action, correct?
That's correct. I'm sorry, Jen, you're right. Like in terms of bats, if you don't know and you suspect that you may have interacted with a bat, don't second guess yourself. Just go ahead and go talk to your provider.
All right. Dr. Jarvis, let's talk about whooping cough. I've seen that nationally cases are up. Are they up in Maine? Are you seeing it?
Yeah, I don't think that we've seen any dramatic increases, and certainly Dora or Terry can correct me on that here in Maine. But I will say that usually sometime during each year, we do have an uptick of whooping cough or pertussis in Maine. It's just something that happens. I will say that one of the great things is that coming out of the pandemic, Maine actually had done a great job at increasing its vaccination rates in children who are entering school. In fact, we have one of the highest rates now in the country. It's been a dramatic improvement. And that is the one thing that we can tell to help prevent whooping cough is making sure that we're all up to date on our vaccinations. I think people think of whooping cough or pertussis as a kid's disease, but actually the bigger population is our elderly patients, our grandparents. So whooping cough actually probably starts with our grandparents giving it to their grandchildren. Why? Because oftentimes they're not up to date on their vaccine against pertussis as well. And so that's kind of really the plug there. And what we've seen, of course, is coming out of the pandemic, we have pockets of communities around the United States that are under-vaccinated. When they're under-vaccinated, then diseases like this roar their ugly heads again, and we start talking about them, even though we thought they were things of the past. So my plug here is making sure that our children are vaccinated, and then our older adults are vaccinated as well. Thankfully, right now, for both our kids and our older adults, that's part of the tetanus vaccine booster that comes with a combination of things in it. For the longest period of time, that did not include pertussis for adults, but it does now. And so making sure you're up to date on your Tdap if you're an adult will help prevent the spread of whooping cough or pertussis in our communities.
Dr.
And
Mills.
I would just add, thank you. Agree with everything Jim said, and I would also just add pregnant people should also get the vaccine every pregnancy. The people who are at highest risk for dying from pertussis, and back in my pediatric days, I actually saw some babies die of pertussis. It was back when I was practicing in Los Angeles years ago, but it's a horrible disease for children under 6 months. It can be very devastating. And it's also severe in older adults, as Jim mentioned. So it's very important not only to people to get their whooping cough vaccine or pertussis vaccine, along with tetanus and others, as Jim mentioned, older people as well as children, but also pregnant people who are pregnant and every pregnancy, because that protects their infants the first 6 months of life, particularly as their immunity starts growing from their own vaccines. So yeah, just put a plug in for that.
Thanks for that, Dora. As the one on the panel who still delivers babies and takes care of pregnant women, I should have remembered that one. So thanks for getting my back.
That's okay. Well, that's why there's three of us, because we can get each other back. It's always... It's easy to forget some details. So,
well, we're covering a lot of topics today. Dr. Vaugh, speaking of a lot of topics, an opinion piece in this morning's New York Times talking about a resurgence of syphilis, especially congenital syphilis. Some of the numbers heartbreaking. How many babies are stillborn because their mother may have syphilis, and 9 out of 10 of these cases preventable. What are we seeing in Maine, and what do you want people to know? Speaking of diseases that people, gosh, thought we didn't get anymore.
Yeah, I think it was at Dr. Jarvis and maybe you, Jen, that you guys were talking about, like, disease of the past, vaccine preventable diseases are rearing their ugly heads. But yes, syphilis. And I saw that opinion piece in the New York Times. And it really did resonate because it reflected a lot of the work that we did when I worked with the Indian Health Services on the Navajo Nation. And I, you know, as I was reading through that, in coming into Maine, you know, these national trends, it is indeed a national problem. It wasn't just a Navajo Nation. We were actually seeing it across the different states. And Maine is not immune to that. I'll give you a snapshot. Here in Maine, even though our numbers are less than the national numbers, we are still seeing an increase in new syphilis cases. If you look at the lines, they are in parallel. It's lower, but they're all going up in parallel. In addition to that, really to highlight this, the degree that we're all impacted, congenital syphilis. So what happens, you know, we're talking about women of reproductive age, perinatal systems of care. What we're seeing is that somehow we have these gaps. And babies are being born with congenital syphilis. The worst outcome of that are stillbirths. And here in Maine, what we had, the last case in 1995, we had a case of congenital syphilis. In 2022, we had 3 cases of congenital syphilis. In 2023, 2 cases. What that tells us is that there's probably a lot more syphilis activity out there. If anything, what I want the listeners to get from this message is that we are not immune. We recognize that it's important to be aware of these things and to take the appropriate precautions, including messaging it, right? Sharing that message, making sure that people get screened. When you see your provider, ask about STI screening, including syphilis. That's really important because you can't diagnose if you don't test for it. You can't treat for it if you don't test for it. And syphilis is one of those complex illnesses that it comes in different stages. And, you know, it can masquerade as anything or nothing at all. And it's really important to get treatment early in the diagnosis and not later.
I'm going to go to Kittery and Julia. Hi, Julia. Go ahead.
Hi there.
Go ahead with your question. Yes, yes.
Oh, okay. Sure. So I'm curious about a COVID issue that I've seen happen with my friends either after the vaccine or getting a case of COVID where they have swollen lymph glands or blood clots. And especially with the vaccine, I know vaccines are so important to help prevent diseases. But I just wonder what the panel has in regards to that. Also, I have a friend that raises pigs, and 10 years ago they started using mRNA pig vaccines for the pigs, and now the slaughterhouses are seeing lots of clots in these pigs. So I just wonder what the best course of action is here to help prevent.
Yeah, thank you, Julia. And talking about blood clots and vaccinations, who wants to tackle this one? Go ahead, Dr. Mills.
Yes. So, you know, the COVID virus is very, it is a big stimulant to your immune system. That's why it's a virus that causes quite a few symptoms and variety of symptoms, including blood clots. And we see that with the virus. We also, because the vaccines have to be also stimulate your immune system very strongly in order to protect you against the infection. The vaccines also are very stimulating of your immune system and can also stimulate reactions, that inflammation that can cause blood clots as well. So there are some studies out there that show that yes, both can stimulate these inflammatory responses, which again are part of your immune system and help protect you against the virus. So you want, you know, or at least the vaccine does, but the so the both stimulate these inflammatory responses, and that can result in effects like blood clots. But the virus getting the infection actually is more risky, for leads to more a bigger chance of getting blood clots than the vaccine does. So it's not surprising when you have a virus that is very stimulating to producing these inflammatory responses that then can lead to reactions like blood clots, that you have it in both the vaccines as well as the viruses. But the studies that I'm aware of show that the vaccines are much more protect you against contracting the infection, and is particularly protecting you against severe disease. And the virus is, you're much more likely to contract these effects like blood clots, so than the vaccine. So I place my bets with the vaccine. So I try to keep up to date with my vaccinations on COVID, realizing that there's some side effects with the vaccines, but there's more side effects, including very severe disease with the COVID virus itself.
Julia, thanks for your question. We'll go on to Dayton and Anne. Hi, Anne, go ahead.
Hi, I just didn't know if anybody mentioned a company called Dog Not Gone, and they sell tick protection clothing for outdoors. So it's treated with permethrin. I'm not sure I'm saying that right, but I bought a vest and gaiters and a neck scarf that are very comfortable to wear outside, and they've been wonderful to protect me from ticks.
Thanks so much for that tip, Anne. And we also have an email from Arne recommending that people use permethrin and not DEET. And we have some nodding here from our guests. I understand the company you mentioned, Dog Not Gone, is a Maine company. So that's a great recommendation. People can also just soak their own clothing. If you're going to be out, if you have, this is my hiking outfit, I can soak this, and it works for several wearings, right, Dr. Mills?
Yes, I do a lot of hiking so in Maine. So I do use both DEET and permethrin. So I have a bottle of permethrin that I spray on clothes. I hang them outside on the trees. So it always looks kind of funny when I do that about every couple of years. And so my hiking clothes, I spray on the permethrin. But then I also use DEET. I keep DEET by the doorway. I keep it, you know, up at camp. I keep it in my car. So when I get out of the car, I just spray it around my ankles, spray in the back of my neck, back of my ears, and somewhat on my, you know, a bit on my arms. But, you know, covering up with clothes as Jim and Terry mentioned earlier, as well as permethrin on your clothes. But permethrin you don't use on your skin, you just use it on clothes. And then DEET I spray on my skin as well as on top of my boots or, you know, around my ankles. Even if I've got socks on and socks over my pants, I still spray some DEET on just to make sure, kind of double cover.
So thank you so much, Ann. Go ahead, Ann. Go ahead, Dr. Vaughn.
I was going to say, I love that idea of DEET at your door. So really, maybe the tip we all should be giving is DEET and sunscreen together as you walk out.
Though I don't
buy the DEET is especially important, though, at sunset, or at least for people with my complexion. One of you said to avoid mosquitoes, and I thought that's not possible. But anyway,
yeah.
I so appreciate all three of you taking the time, especially on this big day with the Maine Opioid Summit. Thank you to Dr. Terry Vaugh, Director of the Maine Center for Disease Control and Prevention, Dr. Dora Mills, Chief Health Improvement Officer for Maine Health, and Dr. Jim Jarvis, Physician Leader, Incident Command, and Director of Clinical Education with Northern Light Health. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.